John Clayton.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming live at 710sports.com. On demand everywhere on the 710 Seattle Sports app. Now, John Clayton.
And Curtis Rogers, I mean, we did make it through this week, it looks like. We're almost there, and this one was kind of a tough one, but it was very interesting. Also, it was great to hear Ashley's voice, and that was great. So, but we did make it through this week, correct?
We did. Well, I mean, we still got 2 hours to go with us, but I think, you know, we can chalk this one up as a success.
Mm-hmm. No, that's true. And, of course, you know, lots of things going on. I don't know if you just saw the tweet that Michael, you know, the attorney for Quentin Dunbar put out. But and I don't know how to read this at all. But he tweeted out that according to the police report, that the victims waited 45 minutes after everybody was gone before they made the phone call to the police.
Yeah, that's
how do we read that?
That's a strange timeline.
Yeah,
and
then
we've also heard that the attorney for DeAndre Baker is also kind of having his own issues with Michael Grieco. I mean, I would classify Michael Grieco as a loose cannon. Do you think that's fair to say?
He's been good to us.
So yeah, absolutely.
Like, let's fire that cannon. I think that's the right way to do it. And the other thing, too, how about the weird one, according to DeAndre Baker's attorney, that he wasn't even in the room. He was in the other room playing Madden.
Hey, Madden's a fun game.
Yeah, but it's like, okay, you brought your own Madden stuff over, and it's like, what's going on there?
Yeah, that seems like a lot of stuff to do just to go hang out with your buddies and play some Madden there. You take your console with you. That thing's heavy, John.
I know, it really is. But, of course, he's a big guy. So, well, he's not a big guy. He's a cornerback. So it's like, hey, let's get into the five biggest stories of the day. Top five brought to you by myself.
Number one.
My general thought is, you know, just go play. We're at the end of the day, we're very fortunate to do what we do, and you know, whatever our job is, professional sports, and in this moment in time, and I guess in any moment, my urge is, like, as we develop culture and as we develop character with our club, they understand that there's a big world around you and there are a lot of people suffering. Don't whine, just go play.
Pretty stern comments by General Manager Jerry DePoto as he talked about trying to just get back and play baseball. And we're getting to the point right now where things are getting a little dicey. I mean, you can see that according to the players' response to the 67-page document that talked about all the things that they're going to do for safety reasons, they're not happy with some of them. They don't like the idea of having to put the uniform on at the hotel and then going to the stadium and then not showering and going back in, you know, soaked type of uniforms. They don't like that. They don't like some of the other rules. And of course, the biggest thing that they don't like is, you know, basically getting a 50-50 split of the revenue. They don't like that. And so we're getting to the point, and I know that Jeff Passan from ESPN saying they really need to resolve things. And, of course, they don't even have a proposal totally on the table yet by June 1st or so to try to get what you could call, I don't know, a pre-camp training, which would not be spring training because we're technically, I guess, out of spring. Or it's still in spring, I guess. And, of course, you got the how you're going to work on the pay, all those different things. And so, but, you know, as Jerry DePoto said, just go play. And so, but again, it's a risk for the players. It's a risk for everybody is going in this setting. And so how this is going to sort out is, you know, starting to get a little bit dicey right now. Players are seeking protection for the high-risk players and access to pre- and post-game therapies and testing frequencies. They want to try to get all those things in there. And so that's what they're asking in return. They want in-stadium medical personnel. I'm sure they're going to get that, and sanitation procedures. But the owners are expected to submit their economic proposal in the coming days, probably early next week, maybe Monday or Tuesday. And it is expected to have the 50-50 split, which is going to probably split what the union wants.
Number two.
Whenever they make this deal, if they get this deal, the numbers will be huge. But from what I've been told, they're not at $35 million a year just yet. The Cowboys' most recent offer is a tad under what Russell Wilson makes per year, $35 million, and a guarantee that puts them on par with Jared Goff's $110 million from the Rams. But it's the structure of the deal that we don't know, and none of us do. What's fully guaranteed, how it's paid out.
Well, nobody knows less than Chris Sims as far as that goes, because he's the one who said, oh yeah, the Cowboys offered Dak Prescott 5 years, $175 million. Now he's coming back and saying, oh, they didn't do this. And of course he did this after all the both sides, the Cowboys and Dak Prescott, said that's not the case, and that's what the accuracy is. They offered less than $35 million, less than Russell Wilson, and that's, I can understand that. And I don't know, there's been reports out there that Dak's asking for like $45 million in the last year of his contract, which would be ridiculous. But neither side right now is any close to getting any kind of a deal. I think that what the concession I think needs to be is that the Cowboys want the five-year deal because for cap purposes, because usually they carry like $15 to $20 million of extra cap for redoing contracts to get under the cap, and that puts them at 5 years, makes it a little bit better on taking the all the accrual and all the different things that they need cap-wise. But if you're going to be Dak Prescott, you want a four-year deal. So it's like, okay, compromise. You know, $34.9 on a four-year deal. Deal done.
Number three.
I think I'll be really far ahead. I've had my iPad for, maybe about a month and a half. So I'm able to watch film, go over some of the stuff that, I feel like I need to fix in my game. And, my trainers, I explained to them what I want to work on. We just attack, So, I'm sure you'll see, more confident me and somebody else that's just going to continue to make plays.
Andre Diggs yesterday talking to the local media about his offseason and what's going on and how the expectations are for this team next year or this season coming up. Of course, when you look at it, Diggs was a great acquisition. Pro Bowl alternate who came here, got three interceptions, 15 takeaways in the last five games that Diggs appeared. Pretty impressive. If they can do something like that, they're going to be in great shape. And so I think that this was a fantastic trade. And of course, you still have to find out about Quentin Dunbar and what his status is going to be. But I think that this secondary looks pretty good, even with Dunbar kind of on hold right now. I think you're going to see better play out of Trey Flowers. I think you can see he's still got Marquise Blair trying to get on the field and they're trying to, Google Amadi and all that stuff. But I think Diggs was a great acquisition.
Number four.
Well, we're in a little bit different situation than the Cowboys. Patrick was drafted a year later, and the negotiations are something we'll be getting into this summer. But what he has said and what we've said, both sides, is he wants to be a Kansas City Chief of life. And that's our mentality as well. We wanted to play his entire career in Kansas City, and that's what we're going to be shooting for.
And that's owner Clark Hunt of the Kansas City Chiefs talking about negotiations with Patrick Mahomes, who I anticipate is probably going to get a $40 million contract extension. It's not going to get done before camp. I can't imagine that. There's so many things right now. You don't know how tight next year's cap's going to be, because if you lose about $5.5 billion of revenue league-wide with nobody in the seats, so they still have to kind of do that. But I would anticipate they'll get something done. He's too important. And, of course, he's, I think, right now the best quarterback in the league, with Russell Wilson being number two.
Number five.
Tiger likes to get in his zone and just play his own game. And I know he's very intense this match because he was the one that was so insistent that we go to his home course. I beat him in Vegas and he didn't like that. It still pisses him off. And I understand. Me too. He was insistent, despite everybody else wanting to go elsewhere, that we go to his home course at the Medalist Club, which is great for Tom and I. It gives us an opportunity to give him a memory that he's not going to like every time he shows up at his home court.
And that's Phil Mickelson talking about the big match that's going to be on Sunday with Peyton Manning involved, and you got Tiger Woods, Phil Mickelson, you got Tom Brady. It's going to be a charity golf event, and it's going to be great. $10 million supporting a charity going to the COVID-19 relief effort. Woods and Manning will be paired together. It's going to be Brady and Mickelson, and that's going to start at noon on Sunday. You can catch it on two stations, TNT and TBS. Good live event, and you know it's going to get good ratings. Hey, you can listen to the show in the 710 Sports app. It's powered by the Dubin Law Group. Coming up next, we're going to talk about Josh Gordon when we go under further review, who's in town and trying to reapply to get back in the National Football League after suspension. It's the John Clayton Show, 710 ESPN Seattle.
Under further review with John Clayton.
We'll review the play.
Well, even though right now he's still awaiting to find out about when he's going to put in his application to try to come back in the league. Josh Gordon is here in Seattle. I mean, at least he tweeted that out the other day. And I think it remains a viable option for the Seahawks offense. And I mean viable, you look at the games that he played last year, the five games, and seven catches, 130-some yards, and make one of the best catches of the year. And he was just kind of starting to get into it before he got the suspension for the final 2 weeks of the regular season and 2 weeks in the playoffs. But, I think that you'd have to think that unless he's done something bad, and I can't imagine him doing anything bad, and if he tests positive, I'm sure at this stage he's probably being tested 3-4 times a month, if not more, that I think it looks pretty good that he will be available, and I think it would be a great move for this team to bring him in. I mean, it would be another bonus. I mean, it was a bonus for this team to be able to acquire Quentin Dunbar for a fifth-round pick. It was a bonus to get Greg Olsen at the beginning of the offseason, and it will be a bonus to have Josh Gordon compete against David Moore, compete against Philip Dorsett and others for the third wide receiver spot. And so what you're looking at is a player who has great ability. He's had at least 100 catch season early in his career. He certainly has had problems with the six times he's faced suspension or all that, but you can see that he was a good fit, and talking to him, you can see he liked it and I think he liked it, and the team liked him. I know that Russell Wilson liked him a lot. And so yesterday on Tom, Jake, and Stacey, they discussed Josh Gordon.
All right, for me, the guy that I get overly hopeful for, who I only saw a little bit of last year, Joshua Gordon. I want that guy back on this team in the worst way. Think about just what you saw out of him last year. Critical third down situations. He was right there making every single play, and then he gets suspended again, and away we go. But if for some reason he ends up getting reinstated in the same way that Alden Smith just got himself reinstated, don't you think that, Jake, I know that you mentioned before that you think the Seahawks might not wait too long on this, but what if they didn't wait? What if they just chased him down and they made this a reality if the league allowed for it? What do you think?
Well, I think it would be interesting to have Josh Gordon back. I think one of the things that you are concerned about is something that we brought up from the very beginning, is the reliability factor. And yes, the rules against marijuana are no longer there, so it would be beneficial to Josh Gordon in that sense that you're not having to worry about that particular situation. But Josh Gordon in his past, that's not the only drug that he struggled with, right? And so to me, there's certain things that you constantly worry about Josh Gordon. But in terms of the talent, in terms of how he fit into the building, how he got along with Russell Wilson and the chemistry that they developed, I would love to have Josh Gordon back, and to add him along with DK Metcalf and Tyler Lockett and Greg Olsen, Will Disley. I think that you're really talking about a really dynamic offense, and you just saw just a small flash of what Josh Gordon, no pun intended, because his nickname is the Flash, of what he can bring to the table for you. And so, to me, I think that would be something that I don't know if the team has any influence over that, or if it's the player that individually has to go through that process and has to, do everything himself. Mm-hmm. Because I'll tell you this, if it was up to the team, and if the team could fast track it or could help Josh Gordon, they would be doing everything in their power to make that happen, because they had nothing but positive things to say about Josh Gordon being in their building.
Of course, that's the one thing that you have to look at, is that he's still probably going to be under the old rules, which would be, because again, he was coming back off a suspension from last year and trying to be reinstated. The new rules with the CBA, you don't have suspensions for marijuana, or even the what you have is that, if you got an arrest or something like that, then there's a possibility of a suspension, but it's now going to be more fines. But because, he's had this past and, of course, is still trying to be reinstated, he gets reinstated under the old rules. But as far as him being available, it's just a matter of him putting in the application. And again, I don't know if it's going to take a month or 2 months or whatever it's going to be, but I would anticipate if everything's good on his end, and I can't see why it wouldn't be, it's going to be be kind of like the Alden Smith thing, that he gets the chance to come back. I would have to think it's going to be the same with Randy Gregory. Certainly he's going to have to, you know, maintain the, you know, the high number of tests to make sure that he doesn't regress. But I think it's a no-brainer to try to bring him back because he liked it here. In fact, and you know, I don't know, Curtis, the fact that he's in Seattle now, is that an indication that you know, he wants this to work when it's available to work?
I think that's absolutely an indication that Josh Gordon wants to be with the Seahawks when he is eligible to resume playing, and when, you know, he's available on the free agent market when he does get reinstated. I think the Seahawks are going to be, if not the first call, the first, you know, one or two calls that get made to Josh Gordon's cell phone about coming back with them. I look at the Seahawks wide receiver group and just their offense as a whole, if Gordon returns to Seattle next season, John, you look at the wide receivers, Metcalf, Lockett, you've also got Philip Dorsett, you add Josh Gordon to that group, and then the tight ends, Will Disley, Greg Olsen, the fourth-round pick, Colby Parkinson, Jacob Hollister's there. And then the uncertainty in the running back group, John, with DJ Dallas being probably the most healthy, Travis Homer also in there. You don't know what Carson and Penny are going to be like come the start of the season, and we don't know if Devontae Freeman is an option for Seattle at this point. So, John, with the uncertainty at the running back position right now and the wide receiver group already looking really good and potentially adding a Josh Gordon to that mix, do you think that the Seahawks could start the season off throwing it more often than they normally do?
I think that's going to go against their tendencies. I mean, again, it's like what they went from, what, 26 or something like that in 2018 to about maybe 31. If you start taking it to 33, 34, I think that's going to be, I mean, again, if you can get more plays, that, I think, can do it. I mean, last year they did mix things up a little bit more on the early downs, but I still think that this team wants to run the football. But, yeah, I guess it's a possibility, if necessary, to pass. But then, you know, early in the season, you might not want to do that because you look at the changes that you're making on the offensive line. I mean, if you have three or four changes on the offensive line, how's that pass blocking going to be? And if you're setting yourself up for penalties like they did last year, if you're setting themselves up for sacks and, you know, Russell Wilson scrambling around trying to, you know, do anything, that's where I think, you know, you need that base to, you know, run the football, and then you try to build from it.
I look at this year's running back group, though, John, and it's going to be the opposite of what it was last year, where Chris Carson and Rashad Penny probably aren't going to start the season healthy on the roster. Carson's got a better shot, I think, than Penny does. But at the end of the year, they should be getting healthier than they were last year, where they were breaking down and getting hurt. And I think that puts Seattle in a much better position because, as we know, in playoff time, you got to have a run game if you want to win if you want to advance, if you want to continue to win. And I think right now the Seahawks could be in a much more advantageous spot than they were a year ago because their running game broke down. They didn't have anything to really go off of in the Philadelphia or Green Bay game. Now you're getting running backs that are hopefully getting healthier as the season goes along, and you've got a passing game right now that can really open things up if you want to go that route. So I think the Seahawks, if you do add Josh Gordon, I think it would be almost irresponsible to not incorporate passing a little bit more in that offense just because of the dearth of weapons that they have.
Yeah, but also what's to say, even with Gordon there, that they don't go more to tight end to try to run the football? Because look at the numbers that they have at tight end. And we got three viable starting candidates there, and that's not counting you know, their draft choice. And so you know, that you got a tendency in this league right now to use a little bit more to tight end just because of all the zones and stuff like that that are there, and you know, get the matchup, and you know, forcing more teams to kind of use that, take away a linebacker and take a safety and make him a linebacker, all those different things. So it's like, yeah, that's going to be interesting to sort out. But hey, it's better to have the weapons because then once you get into the season, you can sort it out. And it does look like, particularly if they can get Gordon back and add either Freeman or Carlos Hyde, they've really added to this group. They just have to get better on defense. Hey, you can tell your smart speaker to play 710 ESPN Seattle. Remember, you can always listen to 710 on your smart speaker or your app. Coming up next, we're going to talk about the rule changes coming up next week in the National Football League, the proposals. Kevin Seifert of ESPN.com joins us.
You're listening to The Professor, John Clayton.
Live from the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming through the 710 Sports app and on 710sports.com.
Well, next week on the 28th, there's going to be some possible rule changes in the National Football League. And to go over that, Kevin Seifert from ESPN.com. And so, Kevin, I guess it's been kind of a battle to try to get the eighth official up there for Sky Judge. In fact, it was such a battle that the competition committee wouldn't even call when they were talking about the idea of experiment with it in the preseason. But it looks like there's going to be a full vote on Sky Judge. Is it going to pass or is it going to probably fail?
Well, you know, there's two rule proposals for different versions of the Sky Judge that would be implemented in the regular season, and I think those are going to fail. But the competition committee did recommend that the league figure out a way to experiment with it in the preseason, assuming there is a preseason this year. And so that is a little bit of progress and at least a chance to give NFL people an idea of what it would look like, how it would feel. It's been tried in the AAF and the XFL, and the CFL uses a version of it, so it's not a completely foreign concept, but the NFL, I think rightfully, is taking a slower approach to it than they did to pass interference review. So hopefully, if the experiment can work out okay, then they can craft a rule for the regular season, maybe next year or the following year, that might actually work.
What is so favorable about the Sky Judge?
I think it just answers the question, or it goes towards answering the question of how can you catch up officiating with the technology that every viewer at home and many in the stands at stadiums even already have access to. You know, we can debate forever whether the officials themselves are better or worse than they were 10 or 15 or 20 years ago, but what we know for a fact is that we can see through technology, HD and all the different camera angles that are now available, much more of the intricacies of the game and much closer views of whether there was contact or whether someone's foot was out of bounds or whether the ball crossed the plane than we ever could. And so the question has always been, do you just ignore that? Do you just say, well, you know, that's the technology for the viewers, but we're not going to hold the officials accountable for knowing, for being able to react on that level? Or are we going to help the officials see things on video that they wouldn't otherwise be able to see in live action? And so what the Sky Judge would do is just make sure that an official, the referee on the field, knows that the replay is showing that, yes, there really was, you know, significant contact between the receiver and the DB, or you might not realize this, but the guy's foot really was way out of bounds. And we've all watched a handful of plays every season where it's just an egregious miss that anyone watching on video can see, and the officials can't do anything about it because it's either not reviewable or the coach doesn't challenge it or it's not under 2 minutes. And so this would basically provide a safety net, if it worked, make sure that the really big misses wouldn't stay a miss, that they could get corrected in real time.
Well, of course, the onside kick has been taken away pretty much. I know you know the numbers of that, and you can give it to us as far as over the last 2 years on how rare it is to successfully get an onside kick. But what chance does the 4th and 15 at the 25-yard line pose? Can that make it through?
Well, you know, it went last year. They voted on a proposal that would, I think, would have been at the 30-yard line, and it got voted down. But basically, when the NFL redid the kickoff prior to the 2018 season, it made it much more difficult to recover onside kicks because you couldn't get a running start, and you just can't. Most kickers can't get enough air underneath it for a guy to start and get that 10 yards before a defender would get the ball. And so I think the percentages went from about 19% recovery rate from 2001 to 2017 down to about 10% over the past two seasons. And that's a little bit higher than I think people even realize. There's been a few kickers who have been pretty good at it, but most, it's just not a factor at all. And so I think there really is some momentum, even though the competition committee hasn't necessarily endorsed this. It's a team proposal, but there really is some momentum to figure out if this could work. They experimented it with it in the Pro Bowl, used it once. Kirk Cousins tried to throw a long pass, and it got intercepted by Earl Thomas. But one of the real calling cards of NFL football is that games are usually pretty close, and there's always seems to be the chance that a team that's trailing, even by two scores, has a genuine chance to win because of the onside kick, being able to stack two possessions together really quickly in a short period of time. And without that, at least the hope of that, it really changes the entire complexion of the late game and the late time in the game, and makes over time there'd be less people viewing it. And traditionally, the end of a game is the highest rated portion of the entire broadcast. And so there's a real incentive for them to figure out a way to make sure that there's at least a genuine hope or possibility that a team could stack two possessions very late. And so this, I think, as team proposals go, this one has a fair bit of momentum.
Mm-hmm. That would, I think, be a good one, too. I was kind of disappointed they took away the overtime back from 10 minutes to 15 minutes. What happened there? Because that was a Philadelphia proposal. And, again, I always fear on a 10-minute overtime, you have ties.
Yeah, and they withdrew that. I don't know exactly why it was withdrawn, but I do know that that rule, whether it's whether it's real or not, that rule got classified under the health and safety philosophy of the NFL, saying that we want to limit the number of plays that a player can be exposed to, not only for health and safety but also for competitive purposes. And so it's a really small number of plays that could potentially happen between the 10 and the 15 minute mark of overtime, but that's where it got classified. And so that makes it, I think, a little bit more difficult to dislodge when there's a health and safety sign hanging from it. And so I think, there's definitely the hope was that teams would be more aggressive at the end of regulation to try to avoid overtime entirely because of that short 10-minute window, but that hasn't really happened too much. But I think that they're more willing to put up with ties, if that's what it comes to, than they are adding more plays to a game.
Now, talk about the injured reserve rule, because it looks like they're going to increase the number of guys that you can pull off injured reserve during the season to 3. And I'm a little confused as to what it is on the day before the final cut that if you put some guys on injured reserve, they're eligible. Talk about that one.
Yeah, I haven't taken a close look at that one. I know that there's just been teams in general who have really – and it's not just the injured reserve, but it's also like the game day inactives and just the various waiver rules, who really are kind of pushing back on the restrictions that the NFL has on those things that make game days less flexible than they feel like they should be. I mean, ultimately, you're trying to provide the most entertaining game. You want to give every team their best chance of winning. And when there's these restrictions on who can be on what list and what and when and how many players you can have available to you, and sometimes that ends up not only affecting the outcomes of games, but also just the entertainment and quality level. I feel like that's part of what's going on there. In terms of the precise wording of it, I haven't looked too closely, because those the rules get changed right prior to voting, and we have to discard all the things we thought about it ahead of time. So we'll see where that goes. But I think teams are definitely, especially as we look ahead to a potentially COVID-impacted season, teams are really pushing, and the league, I think, is understands that there really needs to be maximum roster flexibility this year, especially.
Yeah. What other rules do you think have a chance to pass?
There was two from the competition committee. One, just extend. They're really minor. One of them extends the defenseless player protection to kick returners and punt returners who have gotten possession of the ball but haven't had a chance to ward off impact. So in other words, you can't just perfect, if you try to perfectly time your hit on a punt returner and he catches the ball and you hit him immediately afterwards, then that's going to be a penalty because the punt returner hasn't had a chance to ward off the same as the receiver or a running back or anybody else in that quarterback in that situation. The other competition committee one is really just closing a loophole that we saw on a pretty night game that the Patriots used, and I believe the Titans use it as well, which is to commit multiple dead ball fouls while the clock is running. In those cases, while the punt in a punt formation, in order to basically drain clock. And so I think that like one of them, they took a delay game, and then they did an intentional false start. And the next thing you knew, they in a close game in the fourth quarter, you're draining a minute or two off the clock when you really probably shouldn't be able to. And so that was a loophole in the rules, it was therefore legal. But the competition committee is going to close that loophole and make you not restart the clock, I think, after that initial dead ball foul. And so that will be essentially a delay of game, I guess. And it'll stop the clock. And so long story short, teams will not be able to do what the Patriots did and what the Titans did and some other teams as well to drain clock in that situation.
Imagine that, a Bill Belichick rule exception that now he's going to lose. Amazing. Hey, Kevin Seifert, read him at ESPN.com. Hey, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, John.
High school athletes in our region had their sports seasons cut short by the pandemic, and the 710 ESPN Seattle wants to recognize them. If you know of a local team or athlete impacted by this crisis, use the hashtag 710 Hometown Heroes on Twitter or Facebook to share their story and why they're your hometown hero. Coming up next, we're going to check out what's going on in the National Football League. John Clayton Show, 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to The Professor, John Clayton.
Live from the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming through the 710 Sports app and on 710sports.com.
Well, the vision looking ahead in the National Football League is going to be, is the season going to start on time? And are they going to be able to continue it if there is going to be a second wave with the virus? And news just coming out in college football that the SEC is an all go right now. They are planning, the commissioner just came out and said that they can start doing some practice type things with the football players starting on June 8th. And the plan is that they're going to try to go ahead with the schedule. And so that's the first one to do this. Now, again, how that affects the Pac-12 is a little bit different because, you have, less ability on the West Coast to be able to have big gatherings and things like that. The SEC didn't say anything about crowds or anything, but as far as playing football, Curtis, they're going ahead.
Yeah, voluntary workouts, and it kind of goes in line with how certain states have decided to reopen at different times. Obviously Georgia and Florida kind of being chief among them of the states that are willing to reopen at this time, and that kind of, I think, has influenced a big part of the SEC's decision-making on this, especially with, Georgia and Florida being SEC states. You got the Bulldogs, you got the Gators going down, in the SEC. So it'll be interesting to see how these conferences are able to kind of open up here. I would imagine the ACC would follow suit soon after because that's another conference that has a lot of teams in the South. They also do have a lot of teams in the Northeast, though, so it would be interesting, with teams like Boston College or teams like Syracuse, where they're in the Northeast, and you've got teams like Miami and Clemson and Georgia Tech that they're in the South. You can't really have a conference where half of your teams aren't able to meet and the other half are. It's going to be a sticky situation to watch out there. But, yeah, in the Pac-12, no word yet on if they're going to be able to even have voluntary workouts here soon.
No, but here's the thing. It's like, okay, so in Montgomery, Alabama, they're having a big spike right now. And that big spike, I think they've almost run out of respirators and out of hospital rooms. And that's in the state of Alabama. So it's like now here at the time that the SEC, particularly with the Crimson Tide and Auburn and all that, they have major problems right now in Montgomery.
Yeah, and, you know, that's the risk a lot of these states are running if they choose to open it right now because, hey, there's still – this virus has not been conquered by any stretch of the imagination. It's you know, a lot of people have been able to recover from it, but it's still out there, and there's a huge risk. You know, we see it in baseball where the players countered with their proposal yesterday saying, like, hey, we need, you know, pre- and post-game therapies. We need – medical personnel at each stadium in case something were to happen. And so you wonder if the athletes in the NCAA are going to be afforded these kinds of medical, you know, medical options because they don't get paid the way Major League Baseball players do. They don't get paid at all, in fact. So, you know, there's a huge, huge worry that, you know, if one of these kids gets sick, gets the virus, you know, will the schools be able to cover the medical costs for them? That's a big worry. John, in the NFL today, Jamal Adams and the Jets, it seems as though they've reached an impasse in their extension negotiations. At least that's according to Rich Cimini of ESPN.com. Adams, he definitely wants a deal done before the 2020 season, but it looks like the Jets are willing to wait. What is the big impasse in those negotiations that Adams and the Jets can't seem to get over?
Whether to do it now or do it later. And I don't know. It's like I thought that Joe Douglas showed he's a general manager, showed some, you know, shrewdness in what he did in free agency. I don't know if it's going to work or not, but again, he was very prudent. I mean, he didn't pay anybody over $10 million a year. The highest paid guy was George Fant at 9.1, and he got, you know, out of that, you know, four possible new offensive linemen, one in the draft. And so it's like, okay, they didn't want to spend like they did last year. But in this case, I think this could make Joe look bad because Jamal Adams is one of their best players. He's a leader on the defense. Don't you think that they can? I mean, again, it's not like I don't know exactly what he's asking for. I mean, but the market right now is in the mid-14s. You know, because for a safety like him, who's that good. And again, I think that Joe's being a little bit too cautious by not trying to get something done now, because you saw this with Russell Wilson. Russell Wilson didn't want to be bothered by this when he was trying to prepare for the season. It's like, hey, let's get this done before the OTAs. I want to get a deal, and he wants to stay. And Jamal Adams is willing to stay, even though the team tried to trade him to Dallas last year. And so that creates the, you know, not likelihood, but the possibility is like, okay, if you're the Dallas Cowboys and you offered a number one pick the next year to get Jamal Adams, do you want to do that this year and make your team that much better? Because, you know, they're going down a slippery slope with the Jets with this one.
Yeah, and I bet Jamal Adams is looking at the Jets and the recent moves that they've made over the last couple of off seasons and been like, well, you guys certainly have a lot of cash to spend. How come you're not willing to do that on me here? And you know, you run the risk of alienating him. You bring up the Cowboys, John. I mean, Dallas, they've got their own issues with Dak Prescott right now, but their defense probably not as a sure thing as their offense is going to be in 2020. Would they still have interest in acquiring Jamal Adams if the price matched up what they're willing to give
up? I think cap-wise it's going to be tough because, again, that's the stall right now in a Dak Prescott deal, you know, because, you know, they are always so close to the cap, and so often, you know, they have to redo contracts, you know, replacing base salary with signing bonus to, you know, clear a room, and they usually carry between $15 and $20 million a year on the cap that doesn't really account for players. It accounts for just trying to cap management. And so if you're going to do a deal, and, you know, to my way of thinking, if you're offering Dak Prescott less than $15 million a year, and we'll not ask any questions about Chris Sims because he's been pretty well wrong on just about everything in the last month, but, you know, they are offering him less than 15. Well, you can't have it both ways. It's like, okay, if you don't want to pay him above Russell Wilson and you don't want to give him a five-year, you want to give him a five-year deal when he takes a four, make the compromise. Now, again, I don't know if Dak would take less than Russell Wilson. I think he should. I think that's fair. But again, I think then it's unfair to say, okay, I don't get what I want as far as salary, and I definitely want to get another crack at free agency after 4 years, because you notice most of these deals for quarterbacks in their second contract are four-year deals.
Yeah, because they don't want to be held down. They want to hit the open market again, get that second big payday. And then, John, a little shortly here before we go to break, Dan Buchanan, the former Coug, former Cardinal, former Buccaneer, he signed with the Falcons yesterday. His career got off to a really good start in Arizona. It's kind of hit a stall here over the last couple of years. He's bounced around the league. Do you think Atlanta is going to be a good fit for him?
Yeah, I think so, because you know they lose DeAndre Campbell, the a linebacker, Devontae Campbell in free agency to the Arizona Cardinals, and they needed to get one more linebacker. And of course, I mean, he's that versatile type of linebacker who started as a safety, morphed into being a linebacker, and so I think he can help at either position. And all teams right now are looking for that positionless player, and so I think particularly I'm sure it's going to be close to the minimum, if not that, not more than that. So I think that's a good signing for them. Good. Hey, by the way, be sure to check out the Professor's Notes on 710sports.com. The Professor's Notes are brought to you by Infinity of Tacoma at Fife. Coming up next, we'll talk to Brady Henderson from ESPN.com. John Clayton Show, 710 ESPN Seattle.